morning, everyone. I really appreciate you being here. I'm guilty of never staying for the last day of a conference unless my paper happens to be on the last day. So I really appreciate you are around and I get this chance to talk to you because I really wanted this to be a conversation. I've been in the last less than 9 months, is quite recent, I've been refocused by refocusing my learning and my experience into mobile, and I do see a lot of intersections with autonomic computing that I'd like to discuss with you. And my computer doesn't want to, oh yes, okay. So I'll tell you a little bit what I've done so far that involve autonomic computing just to set this space, and then what I see going on in the mobile computing and what I see as opportunities. So let me start with very old history. When I did my master's degree in Brazil in the 80s, at that time, because we didn't have a PhD program in Brazil, the master program was 4 years, involved the thesis, you know, very long thesis and so that. And I, at the time, got very excited about object-oriented programming, so that was my thesis. And what I did to program at the time, both at Smalltalk and C++, was a graph that you or invoke its methods, and it would observe the pattern, and then switch, change closing, change internal representation from a matrix to a list representation. And I was so excited about this. I didn't get much people to get excited. This was probably the top of my career in terms of readers. This was the first text in Portuguese about object-oriented programming. So my thesis was widely read, and if I had a Kindle app for it, I bet that people would go through what is object-oriented programming, it comes from Simula, what is C++, what is Smalltalk, a little bit of the type theory associated was very hot at the time, but they wouldn't get to the my graph. Even my committee, there was a formal defense and I got no questions on it. I still like it, although of course it's totally outdated, no one would do that these days. If you did need to have a graph to adapt, you'd be smarter than I was in 88, and you would keep both representations in memory, or if it's very, very large, you have two kind of clusters and you'd balance among them. So, you know, it really doesn't work, but I did look at my source code as printed in my thesis. I don't have any of the files anymore, and it did look very useful. In my PhD, I didn't look as much as dynamic adaptation, but when I went back from IBM and I was working at an operating system, a research operating system targeting shared memory, large-scale shared memory multiprocessors at the time, I got my task of giving support for autonomic behavior in the kernel. So the very simple motivation is that when you think about Unix, the way that you implemented files is that that implementation is ready to handle every obscure corner case that may never happen, right? And so the very common path is not the hot path. It's usually not optimized that way. So what we did is to have that when you created a file, you assume the most common case. You are the only user of this file. No one cares to read and write it right now. It is going to be deleted very soon and it would stay small. And I would have that implementation going on. As the processes open the file, it was a normal, you know, Linux API, ABI compatible file system, an operating system, as the behavior, as this object was receiving requests, and we noticed that now there were two processes opening it up on the fly, we would switch the implementation. And the whole, you know, operating system designed to be scalable had all this support to this autonomicity. The numbers look very good on the benchmarks of the time. This is probably around 2002. So at USENIX ATC, we presented that work. And we continue to leverage this support for dynamically changing implementation of kernel objects to offer you an operating system where you could reboot the operating system without recycling the hardware, which for, at the time, I think our machine was a 24-processor machine, very big and expensive at the time. Of course, now teeny, probably had 8 gigabytes of memory. But it did take at least 5 minutes to reboot, just the hardware. And then, you know, do all the device driver discovery and all that that the operating system has to do and the firmware. So what we did then was be able that if you wanted to reboot, would kind of refresh and replace all internal objects, memory management, scheduling, files, network support, everything for now to be fresh. And we got a few papers also at USENIX with that. You know, and it's one line of work that our colleagues sitting at the Hot Software Update workshop is to work on. And again, you know, if I look back, I wouldn't give these very high scores on longevity for the idea or adoption. For the case of the files, what happens is that for servers, for what happens with files, as many of the papers here related to MapReduce show, the file characterization that we had in the early 2000s right now, it's not, doesn't hold for very large scale systems for analytics. And we think about, you know, my Mac OS here. There was an SOSP paper last year saying a file is not a file and telling us what happens when I'm using, you know, Microsoft Office and all those applications in my Mac OS or Linux. And actually, Office keeps a file system for each file. So all my ideas wouldn't work for this new workload. But for many other things, we continue to have that specialization, and we did succeed in getting that into some pieces of IBM products. I continued trying to do very dynamic adaptation, and in the cloud era, still at IBM, you have to go back a few years ago, probably 4, when everyone was really, is this cloud a real business? Does it work for Amazon because they happen to have spare capacity for Black Friday and Christmas, or it's really the profit margin is attractive? And of course, you know, the strategists at all companies were doing that analysis. And when it gets to the technical analysis, the idea is that, well, how cheap can we do? How much virtual machines can you pack in one single server, so I decrease the number of servers in my data center, and still get the customer to be happy? And for CPU and CPU scheduling, there was a very good understanding, but the thing, though, memory was a big problem. Because, you know, people need a lot of memory on their workloads, but the question was, do they really, or can we overcommit? Can we sell those VMs as having 8 gigabytes, but in just, you know, keep them 3 or 4, and when they really need it, we steal from someone that right now doesn't need anymore, and we shift around. And this is an idea that probably came to many people in the industry, given that our colleagues at VMware and many other places have demonstrated that this shifting of memory between done by the hypervisor between the operating systems, it's something that you can do in practice without getting into much trouble. So we started a project called Ginkgo. Ginkgo is a memory enhancer that you can buy at your local pharmacy. I don't know if it works. If it does, let me know. I could use it. But anyway, we're trying to get the provider to be very happy because it has less machines. But the user is all happy because I haven't noticed any lack of quality of service. And the group I was in, but many different groups at IBM, we're trying both a black box approach, you only have the OS, only what the operating system knows, and then you do some machine learning and trying to figure out what you do in triggering this movement of memory from one virtual machine to another, or you really look at how the application is behaving in a metric that is application specified. You look at the memory, you keep observing that and building a model, and then you try to optimize that model to give as little memory as this application seems to need on the phase that it is. And so we did that work. It was a very experimental based. We really had to start a lot of benchmarking, automation of long 15-day experiments involving a very large number of machines where the load on the system really varied. So this it was a seed for a benchmarking effort that in itself proved to be valuable to IBM. And we, my colleagues at IBM, they succeeded after I left, made it open source, and it is, I understand, the spec benchmark for cloud coming up. But we really needed, in order to convince our engineers across the company that it would work. In our experiments and on the papers that we published, we showed that you could really get a very high factor. Give me 100 machines, I'll pretend that you gave me 220, so it's really good. When we did technology transfer to our cloud data centers, our engineers very rightly hold on and said, give me 20%, I'll be very happy. And then we kind of tuned everything to work for 20%. So it is very ICAC-like, that work. And using a lot of things that you guys, this community has published. Regarding, you know, if we can give thumbs up or down, I don't have visibility anymore to say if it is helping or hurting IBM Cloud Data Centers. But I can tell you that even while I was there, on the very beginning, this project excited a lot of people in my measurement. You know, the work that I used to have and Jeff has, the excitement is measured by the number of presentations you do to high-level executives about the technology. And I did so many. I couldn't even miss my time as a professor because it was much more presentation time. As time passed, you know, sometimes you disappoint people because you don't get, you know, it's research, you don't get there. In that case, I didn't really have a chance to disappoint. I think that they learned that there were, before they could increase their profit margin, there are many other problems that they needed help from research and getting a very good cloud offering out. So things like resilience, how to handle failures, can we bring the time to get a system up and running again, when it fails, to be really short, they were very excited about those things and saying, you know, this is great, but if we don't make our customers happy overall, we don't get to the point of optimization. So in my last year or so at IBM, I was fully focused on resilience. And then, you know, it was 12 years. You know, I still love IBM research, but it was time to change. And I looked at something I didn't know anything about. And surprisingly, maybe I shouldn't say that being recorded, but surprisingly, an employer gave me a very good position, to when I really say that I know nothing about mobile. I know quite a few things about other things, but not about mobile. But they said, you know, you can learn. We'll give you time to learn. And I've been learning. And as I learn, I contrast a lot with the server workload, and that's the kind of conversation I want to have with you. So one picture that I like that captures a little bit why I got so interested on the cell phone and kind of late. So this is a picture from Mary Meeker's The State of Internet Yearly Address. It's a slide, I mean, many people here have seen probably, right? But this is, you know, only 8 years, and we have, the Catholic Church has a new pope, and it's probably not very different in terms of the population who would go to probably St. Peter's Square, I guess. But it seems that they're very different in terms of what things they carry around them and how they relate to a historical moment. And I've noticed that every time that you have a picture from Obama with an audience, everyone is looking at Obama through, you know, through this thing. And it'll be interesting to deduplicate Obama's pictures across our data centers, and because there are quite a few of them, it seems. But so it is interesting, but it's not a device on its own. What is happening with applications is quite interesting. I hope to make a little point about that with my talk. And the cloud's there, so you know, you really can't do much, and I hope to make that point, with mobile computing if you do not have the cloud. And then there, everything that it's coming. You know, my colleagues at Qualcomm tell me our processors are, you know, in cars and everything that we imagine, and that part of the echo space will probably be linked to this computing in an interesting way. To give more of this point, and this graph comes also from Mary Meeker's presentation of the State of the Internet 2013, the amount of data that is in our internet and as a whole, increasingly larger fraction come from mobile. So it is really that not only people are buying those devices, but they are using them in a connected way. And there are many of them. And you probably have heard this, but just let's remember the numbers, that the smartphones, while the personal computer took almost 15 years to go from 10%, you know, people like us who buy very quickly Google Glasses and, you know, all that kind of stuff, to the 40%, which is when you get something to be more mainstream, you know, the internet was almost 5 years, and the smartphone, you know, was twice faster than the internet, almost 6 times faster than the PC, and it's not getting saturated yet. Why? Because we have more than 5 billion people who use cell phones in the world. But they're, you know, the feature phones, I think that's how the industry calls, right? You do voice calls, you do SMS, you have a little, you know, alarm application. You know, I had one of those until 2007, probably. And only 1.5 billion are smartphone users. So, of course, for any industry, this is very exciting. There's a lot of space to grow. And, of course, that adds a lot of challenges because you need a lot of data. And then, you know, our 3G, 4G, 5G, 6G, our evolution of cellular and Wi-Fi network, can it keep up? Can the backhaul from all these operators who want to count every byte that we use in order to charge us, can them keep up? So that's, you know, the things that I work with right now. So, you know, mobile is interesting. I don't think you would just like, she's wrong. So that's the easy, obvious thing. What was not obvious for me is that I went to ICAC, all previous editions of ICAC, and I read, well, not very scientifically, right? I'm watching TV. I'm doing that kind of in a relaxed way. Yeah, I didn't have a grad student to ask me to help me with that. So I read every title and every abstract of all published papers in ICAC. And there's nothing about mobile. I said, oh, okay, it's because the mobile crowd, it's somewhere else. And they just like, you know, they know about ICAC, but they think ICAC, they look at the PC, all these data center people, control, you know, queuing. They said, oh, these people will not understand me. They will not accept my paper. Oh, look at MobSys and MobCom, right, the mobile computing. And again, I looked probably the last 7 to 10 editions of MobCom and MobSys, ACM MobSys, ACM MobCom. And I didn't find much. So what I found, obviously, is things for crowdsourcing. So if you're using your cell phone around, you're sending data around so that autonomically maps get updated to reflect the information that you're getting from the sensors. I got that. That day you find quite a few papers in this space. And then resource management in general, that's what systems is, right? We have been since the 50s, what we try to do is give the right hardware to the right application at the right time, of course. And that's the same thing on mobile computing. So you do find things on resource management. A lot of it, not surprisingly, coming from the wireless communication crowd, because that's the first one who went into the mobile computing space. So there are a lot of things about autonomically deciding which network to use and being able to switch from your 4G to your Wi-Fi and from Usenix 2 gigahertz to Usenix 5 gigahertz, or you know, all those things that don't work very well in practice yet, and having algorithms to do that on the system and on the actual supporting hardware for communication, on the modem that all our mobile devices have. A lot of things in networking to kind of get the requests that you have on the network to shift around to fit better how cellular networks as implemented now work. So one thing with our cell phones, I have an AT&T one. AT&T configured my cell phone so that to go from I'm active, ready to take a call, really on the mode where you're efficient use of the channel, to being on an idle channel mode, 12 seconds. It is 7 seconds to go to this mid ground where I can get quickly, but it's not as efficient, to 5 more to really go to idle and save energy, right? So they do that because they want to give us a very responsive voice and transmission. But what happens is that some of our applications, every 15 seconds or you know, every 10 seconds or so, they will send some little stupid thing. So what happens is that the application will really kill the way that it will never go to idle. And therefore, your network is not really working that hard, but it's all the time consuming most of the energy. So you find a lot of papers about adapting how you serve the network interface so that you work well with the 3G tails, or you work well with the interference channels on Wi-Fi's and that kind of networking resource management. Systems, I spend quite a lot of time, initially operating systems and then distributed systems, high performance computing, trying to get the right data at the right time so that your computing can be efficient. Either you want to have it on the cache or you want to, you know, have it transferred to your nodes, but you really do a lot of prefetching, and many of us studied that in school and many of us still work in doing good prefetching. For cell phones, the story is a little different because speculation costs you energy and possibly data that you may be paying for. So you have to be very careful when you prefetch things. And only very recently you start to see papers that are trying to make a case for guessing what the workload is and bringing you the data. So I'm saying very recently, like MobSys 2012 is like the first ones that I found on that space, and even optimizing email so that it's, you know, if I never check my mail from 6 to 7 because I'm stuck in traffic in my car, there's not a real need for Gmail to keep refreshing it. So that kind of dynamic adaptation is, you know, a 2013 paper this week, MobSys is going on. So a little bit of this adaptation is very recent. And it's probably because now it's got to the point where you have so many users that really you need it. So we wonder, is now that you have so many people using those phones, is the same game? Can we just apply what we as a systems community or ICAC community have learned as a workload? Is that same? Obviously not the same. So let us back up a little bit. When you form yourself to understand enterprise workload, you usually get yourself familiarized with how web servers work and how application servers, you know, your favorite flavor, you know, at IBM we look at a lot at WebSphere, for example, and your database. And you think about those multi-tier applications and you think about end-to-end performance and you kind of understanding, and it's a lot about this population of requests, how they flow in the system. If you look at the analytics, things that are more Hadoop-like, you also try to understand all the reshuffling and things like that. Like, you know, I attended a session, I think, yesterday about that here. What people have been collecting about how users use their cell phone, the data has kind of a knowledge gap from what systems we need. So this is IDC data, and this is data trying to guide investors on, are people going still to be buying cell phones, or how much they rely on it? And it seems people rely a lot. 79% reach for the phone within 15 minutes of waking. And I don't know if that's true for you or not. I do use my phone as my alarm clock, so I guess that I'm on the ones that, you know, immediately, because that's when I, you know, snooze, right? But the thing is that people are, using a lot. You know, a colleague here, he was speculating because, you know, all of us keep checking our phones during the sessions. He was speculating if, like, there was all forces of the universe giving a presentation to us about the future of the universe, and they paused for 30 seconds if all of us would be checking our something on our cell phone. But it's becoming a very strong societal thing. And the data from those sources about how the industry is moving, there's none of it. The data that we may need to understand internal behavior of memory access, network access, application behavior, there's not as much. There, you know, the Rice University gave, I guess, iPhones, 3G iPhones to a number of students, and they opted in collecting everything was going on the cell phone. This data is public. But of course, you know, you even wonder, you know, if the way that you use a cell phone that your university gave and is collecting data is totally representative of, are you going to check Facebook as much during classes or something? You know, what kind of analytics? So, of course, a lot of data is going to the operators. So AT&T or Verizon, T-Mobile, they do have a lot of information about what we do. And our applications talk to servers as well, getting to very soon, that can also infer a lot of things. But things are not available yet for us as a community in general. Only 16% of the time is on phone, so I guess it's not only me who don't like to talk on the phone, but like my cell phone. And a lot of people use social network on the phone, 70%, with I think 65 using it daily. Even the number of hours where the Facebook application is active on cell phones has been increasing. So people really are displacing using social applications on their desktops and transferring to this. I have now 3 minutes as I wait for the next talk. I'm going just to check what's going on. So individual usage patterns matter. So for us, looking at the data centers, you know, credit card requests or things, given one workload in a bank, it will not be about very individual streams. But here, there seems to be quite some influence on how individual users work, and the way those applications are programmed, they remind us a little bit about the desktop work. I mean, you don't have that much memory, you don't want to do too much network because it may be efficient. So it is a little bit a back to the future in terms of the concerns that you see with the app developers. What is not back to the future is that if you go back to the 80s and 90s, the number of people who could get that package to sell the software to you, there are not that many. And now, of course, any of us can just do our next big idea and put on one of the app stores of our preference. Another thing may be a little different is that when you think about optimizing at least my work and many work that I did, we could just focus first on performance. And then another colleague would really looking at energy across the data center, but it was kind of separate. And now when you program one of those applications, you can't really separate that much. They come together. It has to perform well, otherwise people not use it, so the user experience has to be good. And so that put that latency and things have to work well. You can't drain the battery, otherwise people will uninstall you. And the data usage may be a problem. Some of us, you know, have been grandfathered on the unlimited plan, which is not unlimited. If you get to a number, they'll shrink your pipe, really make it tight until the end of your term. But at least, you know, you can go there. Other people, they have to be careful. Otherwise, if they pass, you know, 2 gigabytes, they will have to pay a lot. And something is that those resources, in particular energy data usage, is a little bit of a use it or lose it. So if you do the system to optimize things, and you are running your Angry Birds, but you made Angry Birds kind of weak birds because you're trying to save energy, and you clock down everything in your system, but it is the time very close when the person usually has planned to plug in the cell phone was kind of a stupid decision. And saving data when it's my last day on my data cycle is also stupid. So you do have to consider the pattern, and it's a temporal definition about how scarce your budget is, a little bit of budget that will vary, and how important that is to you. So the models will have to be a little on that space. But in general, it works. A lot of the ideas that we had in the server world, they will apply to try to observe what is going on, build a model of what the user is doing, and adapt to that model and optimize some aspect. As with our normal server workloads, if your solution adds too much complexity, then you better have a really, really, really overwhelming improvement. Otherwise, it's not worth it. But that's, you know, engineering in general. But in terms of approach, it may work well. But my conversation with you, trying to say, oh, you know, if you really want to optimize mobile systems, what do you know in systems, you're ready, is a little misleading. And it's a little misleading because even the server workloads that you have for those applications, they behave possibly different from what you paid attention so far, at least based on, you know, the papers I see on ICAC. So let's take a look at it. Who knows what Pinterest is? Well, very good. So I didn't expect many people to know, because 80% of the users of Pinterest are female, and there are not that many female here. But I'm female, and I really can't really get it. But, you know, I have it. I took this picture from my cell phone yesterday as I watched a talk here, a ICAC talk. So, and Pinterest seems to think that I want to cook and that I'm planning a wedding, and I can guarantee that I don't see myself cooking or getting married anytime soon. But anyway, they don't know about me, so they're guessing. Most people care about those things. But Pinterest became very famous. You may have, you know, heard NPR talk about it, because they were really every startup dream. They grew faster than Facebook, but they did have to get the investment that Zuckerberg had to get to build the data centers. Really, they don't have a server farm. They rely entirely on Amazon EC2. And the number of unique visitors in millions per month is quite impressive. So they are right now almost 50 million unique visitors every month. They have served more than 25 billion page views. And they, you know, keep bragging about that they got there without owning any servers. And according to their blog, up to March 2012, they only had one operations engineer. And so they had one engineer, and they were serving almost 18 million Unix. I'm not sure. I don't want to be that engineer. I would certainly not sleep. But they are the poster child for cloud computing now. They had this very prominent position at the last Amazon AWS developer conference, because they get the value out there. And so let's look at their workload. Their architecture is very simple. It's like the one we teach in software engineering in school. You have something to get requests, web requests from your users. You route to some servers. You hope that many of those requests can be served by what you have cached in memory. If not, you go to a database, and a lot of things are, you know, the pictures. This Pinterest is all about showing my dream life in pictures, and pictures, file storage is important. Okay, they gave more detail. This is as of November last year. So at Amazon, they had usually 150 CPU powerful instances only getting the requests from the users, right? They'll get the request. It's a machine that they had only Python with Django to poo-poo-poo and send to one of their 35 other servers who'd look a little more at what the user wants and identify what they can get from the cache server. I believe it's a Cassandra installation. 90 machines, the highest memory that Amazon was selling them. And they also had 60 machines just for their own analytics, logging what the users are doing and running analytics to understand, you know, how can we get value of these, which brands, which companies are really doing their marketing campaign on us and that kind of thing. And for that, they use Elastic Map Reduce. So for the web service, they just used the Elastic Load Balancer server from Amazon. They didn't have to code anything. Their database is MySQL. On that model, very simple, you know, get my space, break in pieces. No request has to go to more than one piece. So each user lives in its one, and they don't have a lot of replication inside. They have a replication on another zone, and in total, like 140 nodes for the database. And as of November, they had 410 terabytes on Amazon S3. And growing. They have more recent numbers. I just couldn't really find a good source. So it's very traditional, all these things. And it is started with 8 databases, 8 machines serving all users. And then they would kind of stop the world, break them. So user A now is on this machine, user B is on this machine, and they grew to 70 as of November, okay? And I took this picture at a presentation that they gave, so it's a very bad picture. You probably cannot see, but they're just telling us that over the day, so from 5 in the morning to 5 in the morning next day, they are showing us that they go from having like 18 servers busy at 5 a.m. to around almost 60 at 7 p.m. And then they go down again. They leave a slack. You know, they have servers that are not busy in case they get a spike. Obviously, they leave a larger one during the day and a thinner one later on. And so this, they claim, gets them to, this is only for the web servers, those 150 machines that Pinterest.com, when you go and click and you try to see what Martha Stewart has pictures there, blah, blah, blah. And that, they claim that saves them a lot of money. I'm a little curious, so if anyone knows, because I keep thinking, yeah, that save you those machines, they're probably $2 an hour or so. But what about the networking I/O and those things that probably they have, you know, when you, if you did deploy things at Amazon EC2 like me, and you didn't really think about how much network I/O you would have when you get the monthly bill, you know, I told my intern, you know, yeah, I can do $200. I'm not even going to ask to my manager. I can get that. And then the bill comes from $1,000. It's a little different. But they do not talk about the network I/O, so I don't know. But if anyone knows, I'm very curious. So for Pinterest, let me just finish Pinterest. So if you are going to optimize, they do everything to try to optimize the web on the desktop. And when you want to run on the cell phone, if you download Pinterest for iOS or for Android, it's the usual trick of optimizing sending data back. Just what is the usual trip? If you're sending, you know, if you have something that is CSS, JavaScript, you embed, you know, put in a given order. So people have a lot of little cookbook about how to optimize that. And something else that they do is who programmed the application. Remember that every interaction with the external API has to be asynchronous and try to do something interesting on the screen as you wait for the thing. So if you have data from yesterday, it's still on slash data on your cell phone, show that data just to give the user something to look at and that kind of thing. So nothing really too mobile specific. And Facebook, you know, as I said, a lot of people use from cell phones. Just for Android, they have more than 100 million downloads, and and we hear that for their long-term success, their ability to keep user engaged on mobile and to monetize on ads and all that is very important. So they certainly pay a lot of attention to it. But the same thing, they have to do front-end optimizations. You may recall that Facebook initially was a web app. It was HTML5. And then playing all the tricks you can do with CSS, JavaScript, and everything, but was not as responsive as other iOS or even Android applications because it was not using the internal framework for events processing that you have on the platform. Like that Apple tries to optimize that if someone touched the screen and that sensor got the information that it just delivered to the application very quickly and that thread can quickly act and get the processor. But because they were doing everything based on web, they were not leveraging those things. They changed their minds. They came up with a new implementation saying that, you know, we love HTML5 and all that, but it's not ready. And now they have native apps, both Android and iOS. But a lot of what they have to do is still getting the data quick enough because they have so much data. So let me refresh your mind, and if you already know this, I apologize. There is a paper last April, NSDI, Usenix and NSDI, where they talk about how they optimize Memcached. And I just want to refresh you that then this is a lot of old business, but kind of it sounds simple compared to what a lot of people did to optimize Oracle or DB2 to retrieve data to serve web servers, right? But they say, we don't go through optimizations on the database layer because we need data from the database, but also from HDFS, you know, from our other file systems. So they have a memcached front. So every query to the database that retrieves something, they will cache in memory, hoping that soon enough someone will ask again and they can retrieve from memory, saving not only storage but all the processing. So they have one place to optimize. So that's what a little easier than optimize a whole, you know, database for that kind of workload. But they have a tough problem because they respond to billions of requests per second. And when you go to one page, a popular page, I don't know, Lady Gaga, whoever is popular, usually a page results in more than 500 database requests for items, just to compose that little piece that will go and come on my screen. So what happens then, it has to be really efficient. So they started with the open source one that works just for one machine, and they start to change it. And they documented on this paper the changes they did. So first, you know, GET, which is the most common because people don't post as much. They really look. Therefore, GET became a UDP and then will set and delete TCP just because TCP consumes too much memory, the implementation, right? They have a UDP with a counter so that they can understand when a lot of GETs are failing and things like that. They have no update. They have GET and SET, but if they want to change something in the cache, they have to delete and insert again, just to make their life easier with consistency, the protocols. And then when someone queries the database in a way that they will change, then they will give a token to this person, say, okay, you have priority to go and insert this. If someone else actually gets in front of you and deletes, I invalidate your token. So you have some, you know, they try to get a little bit of this distributed file system from the 90s, the Leases paper, I think, Osterhout, that kind of, you know, you are getting data, you're likely to change it soon, let me give you priority right now. And when you delete it, they actually don't delete it, they put it a little on the side first, because if someone asks very quickly, they give the old data, because we don't care. You know, if we got 5 comments to our post instead of 6, maybe it's okay. So they will have that little cache of outdated information that they decide to give to you anyway to optimize. And that said, that saves a lot. They realize that certain information, you know, the pattern of gets and sets, they differ, so they will have different servers. And then they'll optimize different for some ones that never change, some that change. And inside each one of those pools, then they'll have a replication. So, you know, if you think about Memcached and you're now using 2 servers, you get your hash table and you divide the key space and one goes to one server and the other goes to another server, you have a way of giving what you want, the key you want, knowing which server you talk to. This is not enough. You put a 3rd server. Some people keep just breaking the hash space, and they found in practice didn't work for them as well, that sometimes just keep one extra copy of a key space that you have. So you have 2 to ask the same thing instead of keeping. So very popular items will be cached in many servers. So that's the idea. And stuff that, you know, surprised me, you know, they did fine grain lock instead of the big lock on the server, and they improved things 3 times. Okay, right? I think that was good. I think, though, anyway, there is a Sigmetrics paper that tells that they get 90% cache hit. It's very good. And the Sigmetrics paper also looks at spikes, and yes, it may be because everyone now is going to a page to see this new cat, you know, new video from a cat or whatever, but it's mostly also about failures. They have spikes when their systems start to fail. So the way they address this is they have 1% of their servers reserved as a trade of all jakes. If I try to talk to a server, I want to insert something, it doesn't work, I'll just insert on this extra one now, and later on I will consolidate. But anyway, oh, and the software upgrade, because they have to keep improving the software, they just get this memory to be shared memory between 2 processes. So they have the old software running, the new software, and they can migrate without having to get the software to be fresh. So that kind of thing. So it's traditional server, really, okay? Before I go to another app, let me just make the last, since I, you know, I did Pinterest and I did Facebook, let's be fair with Twitter. Twitter is an interesting case. So Twitter had this API that they published initially that anyone could just query them. Give the timeline for Dilma. Give me the timeline for Dilma again. Now give me the timeline for Dilma's friends. And anyone could. So what happened in the mobile space is that a lot of startups started doing those clients for Twitter 3 years ago. So you have Twitter Deck, Twitterific, Twitter Bot, and each one of them was differently strong on something. Some of those Twitter acquired. Others, you know, they didn't. And at some point last year, I believe June, they announced that, you know what, our API, that you can, this river of Twitters that you can just call, you can't anymore. Each application can only have 100,000 endpoints, 100,000 users, actually 50,000 because you need 2 endpoints for each user. So if you have your Twitter application and like only your 50,000 best friends use it, we don't care. If it becomes more than that, we'll cut you out and you talk to us, and depending, we can have a business, depending not. So that made people much more careful now about investing on mobile applications for those open APIs. And a lot of people have open APIs. The New York Times has an open API. You could right now write, you know, your very specialized technology edition of the New York Times. They, you know, they have the APIs. They also have some maximum number that seems large enough, but you never know if that number will not change. So these are for the applications with so many users that gets to be data center white. And then all the tricks apply. But what if we want a simple app? You know, Apple announced 2 weeks ago that iOS 7 comes with a flashlight app. Do you have a flashlight app? It seems a lot of people, because, you know, your keys maybe fall in a parking lot that is dark, and then you put, you know, it seems to be very useful. And, if, you know, flashlights, they were all 18 on the free apps. Google Play, this is really high. Very, very famous applications are below that. Does it need cloud? Come on, I know this is... No, does it? Can you run it without a network?
No.
You need ads. Who is going to give the flashlight without ads? Right? So what happens with ads? It will, every so often, refresh, talk to the ad server, to the ad broker. The ad broker has a market going on, and people, you know, the systems bid, and they show some ad. And papers have been published showing that 67% of the energy of your network for very applications, Angry Birds, whatever, they go to the ads. So ads not for free. Right? We choose because we are cheap, we don't want to pay $3, so we choose to pay in data and latency. So Eurosys has a good paper looking at this problem. MobSys this week has 3 papers on what you do. You can imagine, what do you want to do with those? You want to cache them, but it's complicated to cache because it's a future market. You know, I cash, but is Dilma really going to play Angry Birds again today? She already played for an hour. It's not very clear, right? And there's a little bit of this game going on. So you usually need for ads. But let's see, you know, if we look around, you know, applications that are lower, they have only 50,000 downloads. Unique. The way they count unique, both Android, both Google and Apple, they do count unique IDs. Like, I have many Android devices, and some of you may have many Apple devices, and each one will just count one. Doesn't matter how many times you download it, right? So what do you need for those apps? Let's program one now. What do we do? Where do we start? So first we have to, you know, someone has to think about the user interface. And you can outsource that very easily today if you want to. If you're like me, has no sense of style and really doesn't understand anything about usability, you can easily get a designer to do the design for you very cheap. There is a designer market for that, and it's very easy. And so that part, I'm assuming you can get someone to do for you once you have the idea. But at some point, most applications, you really need to store some information about the user in the cloud. Otherwise, you know, you go from one device to the other, you cannot pick up in your game where in the level that you were before, or your data is gone, or something like that. So you do need some sort of user account service. Someone, you know, either you program it or someone does it for you. You need to have a get, a delete, update, check-in. Those, you know, those things. And then authentication. That's easy because a lot of people are these days very comfortable in authenticating using either the Facebook ID or the Google ID or Twitter ID. So therefore, then there is a protocol. It's a call that you do. You do a handshaking with the Google thing or Facebook. So that is, we can code that very easily. Then your application may need to store some videos, pictures, sounds. Sometimes the user account, most of what you found ready for you, it's a key value store, user, Dilma, game level, 3, number of fruit ninjas, 8, or whatever. But it's just, if you really need something that is more sophisticated for your user, then you need to store as a file. And certain things, you just need blobs of data that has no, you know, in general, you can also store that. So you need to be able to manage those, store in the cloud, and things like that, right? I'll talk a little bit more about that later. What else you may need? We're done? Next thing, let's see what I say it is. The notifications, right? So I have my New York Times app. Every time, you know, some stupid team runs, you know, wins an NBA, NHL, or whatever, I get this breaking news, because I signed up for the pushing notifications. This is not that easy to do on your own because you need to code for Android that uses the Google system for pushing notifications. Apple have their own. So because, you know, we need to operate on those two markets, so because supposedly the iOS users spend more money and supposedly Android has much broader user space, we are going for both. So you probably are better just getting someone to give the shim layer that you specify, I want a breaking news and should invoke this function of my code with this piece of data and let them talk to iOS and through iOS to App iCloud or Android, if Android to the Google messaging system. And then you may need messaging, like the Facebook Messenger, you know, just two people chatting, that kind of thing. And you probably don't want to code this as, you know, from XMPP and everything, you just get it ready. Oh, you need this friend thing because your application probably needs some social network support. So you probably want someone to give you the code that connects, gets the social network for Facebook if the person gives you the Facebook credentials, or Google Plus if it's your Google credentials, or both. But usually you also need to be able to unfriend people just for this application, and likes and dislikes, and reviews and things like that. So a lot of that support. And geolocations, all the restaurants around me, and you know, it's a 40 million database of places that's very easy for you to use. The API is easy, so just give me the Java or whatever call and I will do it. Maybe if it's a game, then you need something more. I'm not a gamer, I don't know. For commerce, you probably want to be able to have an easy way for people to buy your virtual goods. Amazon will give you an SDK for that supposedly works very well, integrated with your Amazon credit card and everything, but also Google also has with the Google Wallet, and there are a PayPal, and you know, so you choose your stuff there. Last but not the least, and this we care about, the metadata for those applications. Which devices are using my application? How many users I have on Gingerbread? Where are the poor people who like my application can't buy a new cell phone? And how many have actually opened? And for I would actually know how many people clicked on certain buttons. So I know which functionality of my application is more popular. I really need a lot of metadata to do analytics. And as you collect data about the user in general, the locations, you probably want some more analytics about the user itself. So you probably don't want to code that out. And it's very clear that we want to use those things easy, but we don't want to code. So it's no surprise that right now there are more than 15 startups on... Oh, I forgot the cloud functions. Oh, yes. There may be some things on your picture that just applying the filter on the cell phone is not that good, so you want to send the picture to the cloud, apply the super duper Google Plus auto enhancer, right? That looks, you make you look, actually it does improve the pictures, I tried. I forgot about that. And I forgot about the CDN support, because if you become very popular, the videos, you need to partner with Akamai Limelight Level 3 and get some CDN on that. Some will do that for you. And you need caches. In particular for games and user accounts, you need to be able to say this kind of data, keep, when possible, when there is a space, cache on the device. And you want to just flag. And you want to specify the cache policy. Okay, so this, I think I didn't forget anything. You go to the mobile backend as a service, more than 15 startups. Microsoft Azure has space on it. Google announced at Google I/O a month ago their backend support. One that I was playing with, Parse, was bought by Facebook. So it's a very rich space. And if you go to any of those, they will have almost all of these pieces, not all. There is no one that I'm aware of that has all, because they kind of target different kind of applications. But they have awesome user interface. They work with your SDK for iOS or Windows 8 or BlackBerry or Android. And they will differ on what they are strong for. Like there is one called Buddy, that is very strong on the analytics part, give you support to know exactly what people are doing with your application. And then Parse, the one that Facebook bought, is very good in making sure the programmer understands these operations have to be asynchronous. So all calls are called get user data in the background. That's the name of the call. Really educating the user about what is going on. And they also have very good support for caching. You specify one thing and they will try to do the best for you, manage the space, decide who they evict from the cache on your cell phone. And in terms of analytics, they only catch how many people actually open and touch your application, so not much on that space. There is one called Kinvi that is very good with the CDN integration, so if your application has a lot of videos, you probably would like to look at their stuff, and they also do a lot of filtering and aggregation, so just applications that do a lot of data. The Google Mobile Starter is the name of the offering, if I'm not wrong. They quickly let you deploy some cloud functions on their Google App Engine. It's very easy to use. And they do have support for what they call continuous queries, meaning when the data, some data changes on the cloud, they will update the cached version that you have. So that kind of support. Microsoft Azure let you write the cloud function in JavaScript and deploy on Node.js. So programmers that do not like to write on traditional server things can write that. And many of those, there's App Accelerator, StackMob, there are many of those parts that they're on top of Amazon EC2. How they charge you?
In dollars.
No, but yeah, but you know, you can always get, for all of them, you can get a free account because you're going to pay once you do calls. You pay per usage on the calls. Yeah, and then it's a dollar for a call, 5,000 calls to get or set of the user account and things like that. Okay?
Do they also have the other Amazon like reservation and stuff that they
have in
your call?
Yeah, I haven't heard of that. But you know, it's a very young space. And the reason I said, you know, maybe the ICAC crowd keep thinking, because this is a specialized cloud. It's not a private cloud, but it's kind of a specialized. You can have a target kind of application and really tune those services to that. So I think that there is a space for this autonomous computing. In general, for mobile cloud computing, which I'm not going to try to define or what it is, it's such a, you know, a stupid term still. People will think that mobile cloud is whenever you're offloading something from your application to the cloud, which for most apps now they do offload something. So, you know, mobile cloud in general augments the mobile computing with cloud. So the mobile backend as a service enables the mobile cloud computing. In our academic world, what we have been seeing is more is mostly about offloading a thread that is computationally intensive and running on your cell phone and offload it somewhere else to save energy. OSDI 2012 has a paper on how they do that, which we haven't had many papers yet, is how do you choose which functions to decide to put on the cloud. And isn't the cloud too far, right? The cloud is usually too far. If I really want an augmented reality that I'm walking around and that will tell me, oh, you know, the Google Glass, that's the person, or something like that, it has to be probably the response time that you need for the information to be useful is kind of constrained. And that's the line of leveraging the edge of the network. And then you may imagine why a company like Qualcomm may be interested in having a cloud person like me, because Qualcomm does work on the edge of the network. You know, the home gateways, the hardware for routers and for the small cells. Small cells being the Ofento cell, something that you can get from your provider today. If you don't have good cellular network in your house, that you can get that device that you wire it to your wired network, and it will give you the 3G LTE protocol. And so you talk to that device. The device now gets to your provider backend using your cable or your whatever operator you have to go to the network. So there is opportunity for leveraging that edge of the network. So if you think about it, the previous slide, it may be that some of those services would be good to have on the edge of the network, you don't need to have on the cloud. Is this content delivery network all over again? Not really. Akamai had large populations using certain web pages, and the cache would work because you had a large population. In your home, if you have one device, and you have five people in your home, it may be that those five people do not even watch the same things or do the same applications at all, because they may be, you know, different personalities, different age brackets, and all that. So, it's not the traditional content delivery network, because reuse, caching, may not be as effective. But predictive caching may be effective. There is a paper at WWW13 last month, it was in Rio, where the BBC has, I understand, and people from Europe can correct me, something called iPlayer, which is a device you put in your home to catch BBC without paying, you know, Cablevision, Optimum, or whatever, Time Warner, like we do here in the United States. So what happens is that's on demand, and they collected a six-month trace for 6 months of all those iPlayers in Europe, and a group in, I forgot the university, in England, analyzed that trace, and they trained with the first 2 weeks, and they would get an 85% hit on what the person wants to watch next. We are all very predictable. We watch Game of Thrones 1, Game of Thrones 2, Game of, you know, Downton Abbey 1 and 2 and 3. And we even the pattern, how, you know, three episodes on Saturday, one on Wednesday, and then nothing. And they could really have very, very predictive. On Netflix, 80% is TV shows. So again, you can imagine a lot of predictive behavior. So it is a different game. It's a different game, a little different. And I already, I didn't want to talk more than an hour. Something else that you can do if you leverage the edge of the network and you think about this mobile cloud is that if you are in a stadium and you are playing some fantasy game or whatever they do to keep people entertained during a baseball game besides eating, whatever you do that, you can imagine that app that a lot of people are using probably going all the way to the cloud and back is not very effective use of the network. And it's not easy to provide good Wi-Fi access for 40,000 people. Companies who do that do very well, right? There are companies that specialize in providing Wi-Fi services for some rock concerts and things like that. And it's an expensive business, so maybe there's a space to have these specialized servers now serving just that app locally. It's a trick business in terms of business because, you know, who is going to pay for this infrastructure? Who is the provider? You know, how you do the business model, that may be a little trickier, but in terms of technology, I think it may make sense as long as bringing things from the cloud does increase the complexity. It's the usual thing with our ICAC thing. Yes, it's a neat idea, but it becomes very complicated to manage. If now, because I have my Facebook agent in the shopping mall, because, you know, it's interesting. I know people are here close to these stores. Myself, Facebook can deliver ads much better because the person is just walking very close to the Gap store or whatever. So there's a lot of opportunity. Indoor localization services, you know, it's a hot thing. You know, all the big players bought big companies doing that work, but it's still how much more complicated. You know, now it's more servers that they will break that I really don't have a person. You know, what is my model for the data center? So the takeaway that I hope here It's just to motivate you to, as you use your mobile apps on your phone and you understand how they work on the data center, think about it, you know, if we can really make them better and what we have to do. Is this a lot about user profiling and learning how the user behaves or not? Certain things are very simple. The iOS 7 just added that they learn when you look at your mail or when you open your Facebook in the morning, and 10 minutes before they'll do a refresh. So when you just got out of bed and you need to look at Facebook, it'll be your timeline is now totally, you don't have that lag, right? But that they added on what they call their multitasking support. And it's a simple thing to do under for every user. But when you think more about more specialized user patterns, probably you know, we may want to do that, a part of that on the application itself. And the last thing is that infrastructure as a server and platform as a service, the target people, these developers of these large systems, it's not a lot of people, but for providing cloud services to the app developers, everyone and their brother want to develop an app, and the entrance barrier has been going down and down. So that will probably be an area where simplifying management, getting things to run without intervention at all from the developer, becomes more important, because you not have, you know, the level of expertise that you have at Amazon, Microsoft Azure, Rackspace, you know, you name it, IBM, whatever provider you have, you do not have that level of understanding of storage layers, network layers. You just don't have that. App developers, you know, some of them know a little JavaScript and a little Java, but not a really understanding what is going on the system. So that's it. Thank you for your attention.
So this data, where is how many minutes passed between you wake up and you reach your phone? For what country was that? And
for the United States, yes. The United States, I think some big markets, both, but some in the Midwest too.
Okay.
Yeah. So it's like I was looking at some data about people who buy Fitbit. I'm carrying a Fitbit and another one that is on the purse because I'm trying to understand this collecting data on the fly. Oh, the funny thing is that this guy here tells me that I walked twice the number of steps of this. So I like this better, but of course, the hardware was not designed for the way that I talk. So it probably thought that I walked 1 kilometer giving this talk. But anyway, so in the same thing. The data is usually like when they collect data for any of those devices, they do, of course, the New York area and the California, LA area, but they do collect a lot of data from the mid of the country because they think that that may kind of even out the thing. But yeah, but for the United States, but not only Silicon Valley and Manhattan, it's kind of much broader.
Okay, first of all, I really enjoyed the talk, okay. And thanks a lot. I think lots of information and data, so really like it. So I always positive. I think everybody see that mobile and the cloud will be there, right? So, but I was puzzled is that what is the connection or interaction, the right interaction between mobile device and cloud? So I remember in 2001, I was doing this mobile offloading work. So at that time, it never take off, right? So and recently, I start to see a lot of citations to our papers. So, but I still like puzzled because I think at that time it didn't take off is because not a lot of processing are done on mobile device, right? But nowadays we do see a lot of processing. So there's actually two extremes, right? So for example, I saw some papers talk about like just using cloud as a cloning sort of or backend storage, right? So you don't actually do a lot of interaction between cloud and the mobile device. The other extreme is that you do all the processing on your phone, and you just, you know, do, you know, really just use cloud as a storage. So right. I think that both actually, so the cloning idea is more like, okay, I clone all the operations in the cloud. So then you mentioned some offloading stuff, right? I was just trying to get some So could you please comment, like, right. So what's the right
intention? Yeah, the idea is good. To find the real killer application is not that easy. I've seen the group at CMU from Professor Satya has been looking at this for at least 4 years. Now, one killer application, well, it may be, is that with a lot of capture of video with Google Glass and things like that, you certainly won't be able to index those videos, but you want to do a lot of the anonymization, you know, take out the face of your child and all of those things locally. So now it's kind of, there is a lot of processing that you want to do locally and probably too much for the processor, even, you know, if our mobile devices are becoming increasingly powerful. So there is this augmented reality image analysis that requires a large database of features and tagging and, you know, all automatic that may be an application, but it's not there yet. There are other applications coming from the military, like Recognizance, really sending those devices to walk around on the robot, capture images, and take some decisions locally about where to go and what to explore and in that space. I think with the processing, we have a lot of processing, but what I do see my colleagues at Qualcomm doing a lot is trying to get the application and see, can I run pieces of it on the DSP or GPU or somewhere that is more energy efficient than the application processor? So it's like you do have a lot of more sophisticated filtering that Instagram may be doing on your pictures, but it's still, not that much. It may become more once you get to augmented reality, if we get to exchange more and more videos, then maybe you want to do certain things locally on the video before you use the network, right? So try to extract some things or something, and then decide if you really need to send that video.
First, I want to thank you for the really interesting talk.
Thank you.
So I have more of a clarification question. So the Pinterest example you gave where you show the auto-scaling picture,
right.
Do you know whether they were relying on the Amazon auto-scaling mechanism to do this,
they
adaptation?
Were.
Or they're
they,
not like using their own algorithm
no,
to
they,
figure out?
No, that's their claim to fame, including with the investors. It
right.
is that... They reuse
okay.
technology from others.
So as far as I know, I think the Amazon auto-scaling solution mostly rely on sort of utilization threshold kind of scheme
yeah.
to decide, you know, whether to add or remove. Do you see, value adding, looking at more sophisticated algorithms to say, can I do an even better job of figuring out, you know, how much more or less I need so that I don't need to keep, you know, as big of a margin?
I do now see more. So if this mobile backend as a service, meaning if this company, let's say Parse, is the place where developers go when they want to put the cloud part of their application, so for that company, on the bottom line, if they can really adapt in a way that responds much better and that they save, will probably they, as an aggregate of all their customers, they will have the incentive. You know, for each application really depends on the threshold. And even for Pinterest, I'm still skeptical that when they get their bill from Amazon, that really is the servers that will be killing them. I'm mm-hmm. still a little skeptical. I think it's a little more a lot about this, their image to investors and, when they go on the IPO and things like that. Yeah, and then for that, what Amazon gives them is perfect. Mm-hmm. If you could do that for networking or for storage, then it probably for them, they would want to do more for their own pictures and things like that. But on their business model, actually what they try to do is to help other brands to decide what kind of pictures they put there and how they download the pictures. So they have more of those guidelines about, if you are whoever, I don't know, some Gucci, whatever, and you want to establish your presence here and have your images really cool and things like that, what you should do. More than on the back end. That's at least what I see.
Thanks.
Hi, Zishan from OSU. First, very interesting talk. I'm so mm-hmm. glad you bring out the messaging between different platforms from different vendors. Actually, we developed a channel, you know, open source project 2 years ago called Unikush. You can, the version is very updated right now based on Python and Go. So anyone who's interested, you should just check that. My question is actually in the research aspect, especially in the energy efficiency. For example, the offloading. The computation ability of the of all our mobile phones, smartphones, are very high-end right now. But as also the energy cost of transmission of data, 3G network, Wi-Fi, is actually, you know, comparing with the time and the data size, it's comparable with the CPU cost. Any comments on the balancing of, you know, choosing which one according to the metrics of energy efficiency?
Right. So, you know, what my, and, you know, I drank the Kool-Aid from my colleagues at Qualcomm because I'm not a networking person. Mm-hmm. And what I understand is the industry is going through this very heterogeneous, you know, the costs are very high if you talk to the base station, but if you do talk to a hop that is closer, so if this vision that many companies are putting out from the operators to, you know, Broadcom, Cisco just bought a startup on this space of having those little box to kind of amplify your 3G, 4G, LTE. If you go on that, the energy is much better because it's really, you know, the bands and everything you're working. But it'll be always a trade-off. But you need the network to get to the data. So So there is this thing called Battery Guru that Qualcomm has, which you know you install on your phone as long as your phone has a Snapdragon, you know, their SoC, and it will look at your patterns and kind of change how your applications are configured so that the network is better used too, doing some machine learning to do that. But how effective it is, it can be. Yeah, I haven't Secular tried watch. Myself because yeah, my okay. cell phone doesn't have an SoC. I can try.
So I mean, I know that a lot of people have already talked about this, but what is your take on sort of the privacy issues? Because you know, people always give out things from the cell phone. You talked about Fitbit, so you know, it knows you know, where you're walking and so on. I know this is a lot of debate, but I just wanted to hear your take.
So yeah,
on this.
I was I'm trying to make a case with many of my colleagues for this edge of network, to putting cloud services on the edge of the network. And then, you know, I know about this, I forgot the startup, but the guys from who did Google localization 5 years ago, they have a startup that if you register your cell phone and give it access to everything, it will collect everything about you and give you analytics about your data, saying, you know, you should be putting gas on this gas station, and because it's 10 cents, blah, 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 and you should do this and you should do that, and you if you so it's but you have to give all your data. So when I was trying to make the case for the edge of network, I went to, you know, many people at Qualcomm and other companies in the Bay Area saying, well, you know, people may be willing, we already trust, let's say, your provider, Samsung, HTC, Apple, you know, whatever. People may trust a box from, let's say, Apple that is in your home as the edge of the network and is hosting the analytics there and getting all the value about this quantified self, right? Their, you know, your heartbeat and all everything all day, your temperature and things like that. But I got a lot of things that, you know, privacy as a business, it's not demonstrated yet. So it's maybe, you know, not the time yet. But, you know, things change. You know, we had Prism, you know, the NSA thing, and, you know, maybe not the conversations can be a little different. But so I stay away from privacy. People tell me privacy doesn't sell as a business motivation, and I'm trying to get a business motivation to get a hardware company to invest on software. So, you know. Yeah, but I like you. I am concerned. Okay, thank you.
Well, thanks very much.
Thank you.